Hi.
Welcome to Drinking the Kool-Aid.
Welcome.
I'm Megan.
I'm Hannah.
And today we have part four?
Part four.
Cool.
I like how you asked me.
I was like, how many of these have we done?
Yeah, it's part four.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it is.
Okay.
That feels right.
We got this.
Okay. All right. So I read The Midnight Ride of Jonathan Luna by William Kiesling and listened to Crime Junkie, two episodes of True Crime Garage, and Somebody Somewhere Season 3, which is an 11-episode series. And by the way, our story is on Jonathan Luna. So, there you go. Okay.
And
so,
by the way,
small little recap for you. Jonathan Luna was finally going to wrap up his case against Deion Smith and Walter Poindexter by putting together a plea agreement. He got into a heated argument with the defense attorneys, but he told them that he was going to get the deal done and then he would fax it to them that night. Kenneth Ravenel and Archie Tuminelli did not receive the faxes. On December 3rd, Jonathan's vehicle left the courthouse's parking garage at 11:38 p.m. and went on a path that just doesn't make any sense. But we're going to take a deeper look at the timeline in part five.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just want to let you know we are going to get to that.
Okay.
Just not yet.
Oh, okay.
I know.
The suspense.
After his death, the autopsy report and anything that could be helpful in the case was sealed, and information that was very damaging to Jonathan's reputation kept getting leaked. That's where we left off in the last one.
Yeah, it sure is.
So
you're making me angry.
I did not do this.
Well,
this is
yeah,
not my
but
fault.
Yeah. Got me again with one of these cases where they think it's suicide.
I know.
Ugh.
And trust me, a lot of people truly believe that it is.
Oh my.
So we will get there.
Okay.
All right. Since his death was being classified as unrelated to his job, this could be handled as a state murder case, not federal. A few days into the investigation, FBI agents, well, I say that like in quotes.
I mean, that's what I...
Did you take it that
I
way?
That's how I did, yes.
Good that I read it right.
That was why I made that face. I was like, did I get that correctly? Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
FBI agents were showing Jonathan's photo to motel managers in the area near the Pennsylvania Turnpike where his body had been found. This was an area known for sex workers, and they were basically reporting that Jonathan had, like, this secret life that his wife didn't know about. He had gone to that ATM in the middle of the night to get money, and they thought maybe it was to meet up with a sex worker, and then things went wrong. This, to me, is kind of, like, just a wild story that really isn't backed up by any facts.
Aside from the freaking ATM.
Right.
Okay, and, yeah, but you could really pull money out for a lot of things in the middle of the night.
Tons of things. You could even be getting it for the next day.
Which
like, I've
I
done
have,
that
I have
absolutely
of times. Done that.
Yeah, so if anybody ever analyzed it, like, I will think ahead and be like, hey, I'm going to need cash for this thing I'm doing tomorrow.
Yep.
You know, and that's usually when I think of it.
Whenever I actually remember.
Yes,
yeah.
Of course. So I guess, like, it's a very wild theory, but I would be less irritated if the police were kind of going at any angle and saying, like, hey, yes, this is an area for sex workers, but we're just checking the motels. Okay, that makes sense to me. But no, they're tying it to the money and the fact that there's an account online that they don't even know was his, you know, where he's, like, supposedly looking for other ladies online. We don't know that was him.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't like it at all.
It's just
it feels dirty.
It's a stretchy story.
Right. And it just feels too much like we're pinning something on him.
Yep.
That we don't have any way to back up. In a document filed with the Howard County, Maryland Register of Wills dated October 8th, 2004, Angela Luna listed her husband's credit card debt as a total of $17,677. This was the combined total from four credit cards. So that would be $9,034.47 on his American Express, $8,500 on an MBA account, $110.69 on a Citicorp account, and $32.44 from Citibank. So, like, honestly, from my point of view, I don't think this is that wild.
No.
I've known people with a lot more debt.
It's not great, but...
No.
Definitely not awful, like, compared to what it could be.
With his job, I have to assume that he had a decent income. And then his wife was in the medical field. I believe she was like an OBGYN.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So there has to be some decent income here. So that's why I'm like, you know, just guessing, but I don't think it's that crazy.
But no, I mean, I agree.
I don't know.
I agree.
It's not even close to the amount that was actually reported, though. Investigators claimed that he had $25,000 in credit card debt. And the son reported that he had as many as 16 credit cards and some that his wife didn't know about.
Okay, that is a lot.
Yes, but a lot of people don't close their credit cards. So it depends on if they're saying 16 that he's actively using. But if
or
you
16 in general.
Yeah, because I know that it changes your credit score.
Yeah.
In a negative way, if you close a card. So they always say to leave them open. So, I mean, if you looked at mine, honestly, I might have had that many at some point in my life.
Okay.
You know, because when I was younger, I would get them at like the different stores, like, you know, Maurice's and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, you were brave enough to do that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I've never been brave enough to fuck around with that.
Yeah, no, I had credit cards for like all those little stores.
Oh.
Yeah.
I have one.
Okay. So I'm just saying that, like, you know.
Oh, man.
No, I'd go to the mall, like Victoria's Secret, Maurice's. You have a different credit card for all of them.
I was literally never brave enough.
Life was wild. Okay?
They would try to get me to do it, and I'd be like, fuck no.
Are you kidding? You get like the little perfume set and stuff if you sign up.
Oh, that definitely makes it worth it. Gotta get the little perfume set.
Yeah. God. So I'm just saying, people have different credit cards for different reasons. So it actually might not be that weird.
Right. Like some people just want to get the little perfume set.
Exactly. okay. On the morning of Jonathan's death, Angela received a call from the federal courthouse and they were asking where he was. She said that he had not come home that night and she didn't hear from him since the night before. She had no idea where he was and she was the one that called the police to report him missing when he did not come home. After she was thrust into this nightmare of finding out that he had been murdered, the FBI made it more excruciating when they drug her husband's name through the mud. They painted him to be a thief. Because they said he stole the $36,000 from that court case. He had a secret life. He had credit card debt. They said that he was gay or bisexual. And then they said his genitals were mutilated by a sex worker.
Okay, what the fuck?
So that's why I'm so frustrated.
Some of those were relevant.
Most aren't, yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, and that's why I say, like, this one just to me feels so intentional with the rumors that are starting.
I hate when people start rumors about people that can't
defend themselves. Yeah, it's not fair. And, I mean, this poor family is already going through enough, and now they have to hear all this bullshit, you know, about Jonathan.
It's like, I can't imagine how they're feeling at this point.
No. On December 14th, 2003, Jonathan's friends and family gathered together. It was the night before his memorial service and funeral, and so they met at his home. Angela kept saying she just didn't understand, like, who would do this to her husband? He had been known for maintaining good relationships with people, and he even stayed in touch with his ex-girlfriends. This gathering was interrupted by two female FBI agents. They pulled Angela aside to tell her that they needed to go upstairs and take pictures. Several minutes later, another set of FBI agents arrived. They were wearing latex gloves, and they began searching upstairs. Friends and family had been there to mourn together and support each other, but this interruption was deeply unsettling, and some of the people actually had to leave and go drive around for a while because they were so upset. After the upstairs was searched, the agents headed to the basement bedroom, and this is where Jonathan's mother-in-law had been living. They spent a long time in there, and when they emerged, they were carrying Ziploc evidence bags. The agents began moving the group of people from room to room so that they could continue their search.
That's really nice. Move the mourning people back and forth.
Right. And the group was confused about things. Like, why did they pick that day to search the house? The day that they were gathering to mourn together. The so-called agents never properly identified themselves or even produced a card to show them. Like, why were they searching? Yeah. And so this search was 11 days after his death, which to me is a little weird. Not that they're still continuing to search at that time. It's just like, okay, you've already waited 11 days. What's one more?
That's true.
I just don't get it. You know, like, we got to be a little sensitive about things, maybe. I don't know.
I mean, did they know that that was the day that they were?
I don't know.
Because it's like, if they just, like, showed up and didn't realize, but then also, like, couldn't you just be like...
If you see cars everywhere.
Couldn't you just be like, you know what, like, just a heads up, we need to come in there, but we'll do it tomorrow, or, like...
Yeah.
Even just roll away and come back the next day.
Right, and the thing is, like, this is unannounced, so if you do, yeah, you pull up and you're like, oh, shoot, there's, like, 20 cars here, maybe now's not the best time. I don't know. It feels weird to me, and... In my mind, there's really no way they didn't know that his funeral was the next day. Maybe they didn't know they were meeting at the house, but you knew when his funeral was, you know?
Okay, yeah.
Like, this was very publicized information.
Okay.
Jonathan Luna's body had been transported to Witski Funeral Home in Ellicott City, Maryland, and the undertaker, Kim McLeod, embalmed him. She said, quote, I've seen lots of murders, but this was definitely the worst one I've ever seen.
Wow.
And that's got to say a lot.
I mean, it truthfully does.
She had been selected to work on his body because she knew the pastor of his church, and she had extensive experience working with badly damaged bodies. Kim was really confused.
Okay, so she is extensive.
Uh-huh.
In badly damaged bodies.
Exactly.
And this is the worst she's seen. Woo.
Yes, and that should say a lot.
Okay.
Even though the autopsy report has not been unsealed and people can't access it, this should hold a lot of weight, at least in my eyes.
It does in my mind, yeah.
Yeah. So she was confused right away because she was told that this was a suicide case, but she said that's just not possible. There were stab wounds on Jonathan's back. They were in the middle of his back and around his shoulder blades. She also said that his hands had been, quote, shredded. Kim explained that there were long cuts between all of his fingers and cuts to the front and back of both hands. The deep cuts were like slicing razor wounds that peeled away the skin around his fingers and in some places cut down to the bone. This is indicative of someone being slashed with a knife and trying to block those stabs. These are defensive wounds. Kim said that she tried to sew them up the best that she could do, but they actually had to put gloves on for the viewing.
That says a lot.
I agree.
Because, I mean, they, especially if her, again, her specialty is, like, more mangled type bodies. And, like, they deal with car accidents and all sorts of shit.
Yeah.
And somehow make people viewable.
Right. And this one, she did her best, but she's like, I can't, you know, he's got to wear gloves.
That's really, really bad.
She also had to sew his throat, which was cut all the way around and had been slashed open on the right side. His scrotum had been slashed open, and it wasn't a clean slash. Kim said it looked like someone had been, quote, working on it.
Oh, no!
Yeah. His funeral was held on December 15th of 2003, but the authorities suddenly found a knife 6 weeks after his death. So this would have been in January of 2004. Kim said...
Found a fucking knife where?
Well, let me tell you. Kim said they actually found two knives, but this wasn't the information that was told to the public. It had also been released that most of the wounds were pinpricks or shallow, like, hesitation marks. But if that's the case, why would there be an additional $1,995 charge for professional services on the funeral home bill due to extensive sewing of the wounds on his body?
Right, and pinprick my ass, his fingers were sliced open, dude.
Right, and had to be covered with gloves. Like, if it was just small pinpricks, you would be able to sew that up.
What is happening?
A lot of weirdness. Prior to Jonathan's death, he had been planning a trip with his father to the Philippines, and he told his brother that he was actually really, really looking forward to this trip. Instead, on December 15th, his father was a pallbearer.
That was so sad.
I know. It's awful.
The way you dropped that on me, that was so sad.
I mean, it just like really makes you think, because you're planning this trip. He's supposed to have a lot of fun, you know, and hang out with his son. And instead, no, he's a pallbearer at his son's funeral.
Life is short, people.
For real. Too short.
Live it while you can.
Mm-hmm. There are many conspiracies looped into this case, and one is the number 36.
Okay. You said that very ominously.
It was $36,000 that went missing in a court case that Jonathan was involved in, and it was 36 stab wounds on his body.
I wondered if you were going to say that. Oh, that's weird.
Was someone sending a specific message?
That's weird.
Was he getting ready to expose someone? Jonathan had several shallow wounds surrounding his deeper wounds. Did someone intentionally add small wounds after administrating those deep wounds? This could be used to throw off investigators. Maybe someone was trying to stage it as a suicide. Here are some of the things that fall into, like, the conspiracy. So here's just a little recap for you. Leading up to the murder, $36,000 went missing, and those included in this would be the FBI agents and the lawyers who said the money had been returned. Jonathan Luna was part of this, and so was attorney Kenneth Ravenel. The day of Jonathan's murder, he agreed to a plea deal in the Smith and Poindexter case. Smith's attorney was Kenneth Ravenel, a lawyer involved in the case when $36,000 went missing, and this does remain unsolved today. Warren Grace, the FBI's informant, was under house arrest but mysteriously had drugs in his possession due to FBI oversight, and Jonathan failed to disclose this in the pretrial discovery. $200 was withdrawn from Jonathan's ATM at 1 a.m., and the cameras in the lobby of the rest stop weren't working. At 2:37 a.m., his car entered the New Jersey Turnpike, avoiding the Easy Pass and taking a ticket. At 3:20 a.m., his car stopped at the rest stop to get gas, and the cameras weren't working. His car passed through the turnpike exit at 4:04 a.m., and there was a spot of blood on the turnpike ticket. Money was lying around Jonathan's car at the scene of the crime, but his wallet was missing. Reputation damaging information was leaked by an FBI agent. Let me ask you this. Who handles informants? Who could know if a security camera is defective in a specific location? Does this all trace back to Jonathan Luna? Or do all roads lead back to the FBI? During...
That was a good setup.
You like that?
I did.
During this specific time frame, the FBI was being scrutinized for their mishandling of informants.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. They had informants who were known murderers, which is supposed to be against the rules, and they had agents that were involved in murders and cover-ups. In November of 2003, just a few weeks prior to Jonathan's death, the FBI released a statement, quote, "While the FBI recognizes there have been instances of misconduct by a few FBI employees, it also recognizes the importance of human source information in terrorism, criminal, and counterintelligence investigations." In early December, which is just days prior to Jonathan's death, his boss, U.S. Attorney Tom DiBaggio, was getting ready to hand down an indictment against Maryland's top officer. State Police Superintendent Edward Norris and Edward's former chief of staff, John Stradini, for broad-based corruption and fraud in the handling of police accounts. They were caught running a sex ring out of Baltimore Police Headquarters.
Awesome!
So that's pretty big. The investigation...
Jesus, dude.
I know, it's so much to take in here.
Holy.
So much. The investigation had begun when Edward Norris was working as Baltimore City Police Commissioner under Democrat Mayor O'Malley. He left the Baltimore Department in December 2002, and a series of federal subpoenas started rolling in about a week before Jonathan Luna's death. Several months after Ed Norris was sworn in as the state's top cop, Jonathan's boss, Tom DiBaggio's office, requested an audit of a supplemental Baltimore police account. This audit showed a discrepancy of $7,700 in funds that were misused for Ed Norris's personal expenses. Soon, several cops were being accused of using this police account for sexual endeavors.
What?
Well, they were getting luxury hotel suites.
Oh my God, no.
Buying Victoria's Secret lingerie,
mm-hmm.
alcohol,
mm-hmm.
and meeting up with sex workers.
Uh-huh.
They were using other officers as a cover-up by incurring bogus overtime expenses to fund this.
Uh-huh. Wow.
The corruption runs deep, folks.
Wow.
Yeah.
That. Wow. That's something to take in.
Holy. It really is. It's a lot. On December 10th of 2003, less than a week after Jonathan Luna's death, U.S. Attorney Tom DiBaggio announced the indictment of Maryland State Police Superintendent Edward Norris and his chief of staff, John Stradini. They were both charged with misusing a secret police fund for personal use and romantic encounters. On the morning, I see you flipping your hands up.
I'm flipping them over here.
Yeah.
I am not happy.
Okay. On the morning of the indictment, Ed Norris resigned. But the governor said he could have his job back if he was cleared. Both men pled guilty at first, but then it gets more complicated. Ed Norris bought a house with a down payment of $10,950. On his mortgage application, he listed the down payment as a gift from his father, Ed Norris Sr., a retired NYPD captain. Ed Norris Sr. gave his son the down payment after his driver, Tom Tobin, had given Ed Norris a check for the same amount, and then Ed Norris had given the money to his father. And I know that's really, really confusing, but basically, you guys, this is money laundering.
Okay, got it. Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I was like, huh?
In the basic form,
there was just a lot of
money
happening.
Laundering.
Got it, yes. Okay.
2 weeks before Jonathan's death, Ed Norris's father was subpoenaed to testify before a federal grand jury. On December 10th, Ed Norris and two of his top co-conspirators were indicted by Jonathan's former boss, Thomas DiBiagio. The secret police fund was being used to fund many nefarious activities, and the officers were signing letters authorizing fund disbursements that made it look like the money was being used for legitimate
for good purposes.
Business.
Oh my God.
Yes.
These fuckers.
Uh-huh. It's real fucked. Norris and Strandini were members of the EPU, so it's Executive Protection Unit. When somebody needed the money, the EPU member would deliver an authorization letter and the check would be cashed. Then the EPU member would hand the cash to Norris and he would give it to the person that was requesting the money from the secret fund. That's how they were able to keep it hidden for so long.
Oh.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, when you honestly think about this for a second, there's so many people involved. And that's scary. That's so scary that a bunch of people in power were all in on this thing.
It's like murderers, man.
I know.
They just are drawn to each other somehow.
Yeah, they always find each other. It's unbelievable.
Some freaking how everybody like that finds each other.
Yes.
I don't get it, but...
I know.
That's exactly like the situation here.
It's crazy. Several EPU members and several women would later testify that Strandini allowed Norris, a married man, to use his apartment for romantic encounters with ladies that were not his wife. And this happened during the workday. And sometimes this happened like several times a day.
While he was on the clock.
On the clock.
Mm.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
He was hooking up with women on the clock, and other EPU members would have to wait for him at other locations during this time.
Oh.
So they were also on the clock.
Wonderful.
And he was forcing them to get overtime pay to do this.
Even better.
Yeah. One of the odd things here is that there was basically a sex ring happening, and it was Jonathan's boss that was indicting these people. And there was a very similar sex ring happening in Pennsylvania from a county courthouse that was near the area where Jonathan's body was discovered.
What the fuck?
Right. And that's kind of why I put this in here, is because I'm like, there's a lot happening all around Jonathan, you know? I'm not saying he's necessarily involved in this stuff. It's
but
just
it's
a lot of weird
shit. No, it is. It is.
Ed Norris pleaded guilty to his part in this scandal, and that was pretty much it. Like, it was swept under the rug, but he was facing a possible 30-year sentence for mortgage fraud. He accepted a plea deal and served 6 months in prison. He had another 6 months of home detention and 500 hours of community service. So, that's it. He later met up with the author of The Midnight Ride of Jonathan Luna, and he had an interesting story. Ed Norris said that the women mentioned in his indictment were friends or acquaintances of his. FBI agents asked him to lie about corruption in Martin O'Malley's administration because they were trying to falsely indict O'Malley. Ed Norris refused to get on board with that plan, but he also mentioned that the governor refused to talk to the U.S. attorney the entire last year that DiBiagio, Jonathan Luna's former boss, was in office. At the time of Jonathan's death, there was a lot of organized crime activity, including slot machine gambling in Maryland and Pennsylvania, and this all tied into the mob. In early March of 2007, Jonathan's previous boss, former U.S. attorney Tom DiBiagio, called a New York Times reporter to say that he had been forced out of his job because he had been investigating alleged ties between gambling proponents and staff members for former Maryland Republican Governor Bob Ehrlich. And I know there's so many stories inside of this story, so hopefully it's easy to follow here.
I mean, so far I'm keeping up.
Okay. DiBiagio said that he felt like his life was being threatened during the investigation, but the FBI refused to protect him. he was being pressured to stop the investigation. At the same time, over in Pennsylvania, a convicted felon with known ties to organized crime was seeking a casino license by giving office holders in both political parties large campaign contributions. In Pennsylvania, the mob
is a service provider.
The Pennsylvania Turnpike Commission, whose highway had been used by Jonathan Luna on his last night alive, is a dumping ground for organized crime.
Oh, okay.
So, what if he had stumbled across something that he wasn't supposed to? I mean, corruption is clearly surrounding this man. So I don't feel like it's that far-fetched to believe that he accidentally saw something he wasn't supposed to.
I could agree with that.
After Jonathan's death, several agents who worked with him were questioned. A review of his files showed that there was a female agent who had submitted several cases to him. So she was obviously questioned, and then she got really upset and resentful about this. She filed a complaint against her superiors, and on February 11th of 2004, the CBS network reported, quote, troubling developments that suggest the Luna investigation has become a major embarrassment. The report stated that supervisors at the FBI's Baltimore field office were focusing on their own female agent as a possible suspect in the case. It was being spun as a personal relationship that went bad, so they're back on that.
I don't know how they keep getting back to that specifically.
I think, honestly, that it's because they were trying so hard to make it look like this
to
was...
To build it around that?
Yeah, like a female sex worker or something of that nature. Like he was cheating on his wife. That was the only thing that they had.
I was going to say, because that seems to be the only thing they keep running to.
Yeah. Since this female FBI agent had referred several cases to Jonathan for prosecution, investigators were accusing her of having an affair with him. This made no sense for a few reasons. First, why release a statement like this before thoroughly investigating the lead and making sure you're right, which they were not? Second, Jonathan was a very muscular guy. How did this woman completely overpower him? And that's not to say that women cannot, like, I'm not saying women are weak.
You backtrack so fast.
I don't want anyone to twist it and think I'm saying, like, a woman can't kill a man.
I know, I knew what you meant. It just, the brakes that you hit.
Yeah. I was like, no.
You threw it in reverse so freaking hard.
Hold on. Let me explain.
I knew where you were trying to go with that, though.
So he was an avid runner. He was very fit. It just seems less likely, especially knowing that he was stabbed. It just shows, you know, how many stories the FBI is willing to leak to the press and send everybody on this wild goose chase. That's what it looks like to me. It just felt weird.
Yeah.
To be like, oh, now it's probably this female.
I mean, yep.
Like, okay, fine, if it's her, let's make the story fit, but you didn't. It doesn't make sense.
I mean, if there was any type of evidence out there, but yeah.
I think it comes down to the slashing of his scrotum, which is a little weird to me because they've actually backtracked and said that that's not true.
That he wasn't slashed there?
Right. I'm going to go ahead and believe the people that were working on his body after he was dead, but the FBI has been like, eh.
I would have to agree with that.
Yeah.
But again, that can be a case of somebody trying to make it look that way.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
I mean, it could go either way, obviously, but.
Yeah. No, that's a valid point, for sure.
It absolutely could be somebody trying to be like, oh, this is the best out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. That's why I wish they would just release the autopsy report, because honestly, it would put a lot of things to bed. Really.
Well, that's probably why they won't.
I know. The two agents, Gary Bald and Jennifer Smith Love, that were spewing out all these lies to reporters were just trying to advance their own careers.
Oh.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
Like, that it's checks. Repulsive to me that they would deliberately ruin his reputation to help themselves.
No, it definitely is, but that checks with how everything else has been so far.
Yes. And there are strange things going on with this whole scenario, too.
There are strange things happening every freaking where.
I know. Gary Bald was appointed agent in charge in late 2002, and that timing would coincide with the $36,000 that went missing. That would also coincide with the Dawson family murders and the mishandling of FBI informant Warren Grace.
It's a pretty big quinky-dink.
Sure. Jennifer Smith Love was named acting agent in charge of the Baltimore office in November 2003, just weeks before Jonathan's death. Gary Bald and Jennifer Smith Love oversaw the office that lost the $36,000 and allowed Warren Grace to run wild in the streets. As of the time that the book was written, both agents were working pretty high up in the FBI. So I'll just leave that there.
Just so many coincidences.
It just all keeps tying back in.
Yeah, sure does.
When CBS released the leaked information, they also mentioned that field agents had found the knife that they believed was used in Jonathan's stabbing, and they had a, quote, very promising suspect.
Oh my fucking God, I forgot about the knife.
Here it comes.
Holy crap, you brought me down such a rabbit hole just now that I entirely forgot.
I know.
That you'd brought up the knife.
This story is so twisted.
Did you ever tell me where it was found?
Of course I didn't.
Oh my God.
It had to come back up right now.
I did.
Because now, wow. I'm going to tell you about the knife and the very promising suspect.
I don't know if that was my ADHD or you were really slick with that, but I entirely forgot that I even asked about the knife.
I think I'm really slick. No. If I have to guess.
Of course you do. That, I mean, seriously, I remember being like, what? They found another knife? And then you
and
took
I just
me,
barreled on through.
You did. And oh my God, I forgot about the knife.
Well, let's start with the promising suspect.
All right, fine. You're not going to... When are you going to tell me where it was?
Hold on.
Okay.
Okay.
Fine.
So, the suspect was Jonathan Luna. Yeah.
No! Okay. I'm ready.
Gail Gibson had posted an article for The Sun that said she spoke to three law enforcement sources who wished to remain anonymous, but they said Jonathan took his own life. These sources claimed that they had access to FBI reports. The article said that Jonathan had filed an internet loan application to borrow $30,000, and then the loan was just canceled soon after the $36,000 went missing in court. So Jonathan was accused of stealing the money, and that's why he no longer needed the loan. According to the FBI's own statistics, Jonathan was lower on the list of suspects for stealing the money. They did a beta report, which is behavioral and ethic trends analysis, and it actually points towards their own agents as the probable suspects.
Ah!
So I found that kind of interesting.
And again,
The beta report says that an agent with only an undergraduate degree is 5 times as likely to commit misbehavior as an employee with a law degree. That's 60.2% likelihood versus a 12.5% incident rate. Jonathan was a new employee, and according to the beta report, that further decreases the likelihood of this kind of behavior. Also, the stab wounds were on his back. So,
yes.
There's that.
And don't make me sit here again and do the whole arm reaching behind me yet again.
I know.
For another case, because it's going to be uncomfortable, just like it was the first time.
Yeah.
And it's just going to piss me off more.
Okay, let's get into the knife.
Oh,
because
oh
I know
my
that's
God.
What you're waiting for.
Yes!
On March 8th, 2004, the Washington Post published an article titled, quote, "Prosecutor may have killed self. Lack of evidence fuels theory in Luna's death." Alan Langle and Eric Rich said that unnamed law enforcement sources say that they believe Jonathan's own pocket knife or pen knife was used in the stabbing. After repeatedly searching the area where his body was found, investigators found the knife embedded in mud in the creek. They said that the knife was found in January of 2004, but I'm going to tell you what, that seems a little impossible because according to the undertaker, they knew about the knife before Jonathan's funeral. Since the knife had been supposedly sitting in the creek, it was conveniently cleaned by the stream.
Any fingerprints. Yeah, naturally.
Reporters were saying that Jonathan was set to take a polygraph test about that missing $36,000, and he just couldn't take the pressure of being caught. So that's why he ended his life.
So he ended his life and then he put his own knife in the water to wipe his own fingerprints off?
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Some talent happening
and see,
here.
Here's the thing. When I bring up the fact that the undertaker knew that there was another knife before the funeral, basically it's two small pen knives or, you know, like two very small pocket knives.
Right.
So how do you know that there's two of them versus one? Like, you already found one in his neck. How did you know there was another?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it has a different knife on it. Like, maybe one's serrated and one isn't. I don't know. It's never been explained. But it just seemed a little strange to me. Like, did somebody say something? I don't know. After the Washington Post published the article about this, the Baltimore U.S. Attorney's Office wrote a letter to say that they did not believe the missing money had anything to do with his death, and the letter was addressed to Nako Brown in prison. It was his case that was being tried when the money went missing. He was surprised to learn about Jonathan's murder, but he was also shocked to find out that attorney Kenneth Ravenel was involved in the Smith and Poindexter case because he had also been involved in the missing money case. So why was everybody looking so hard at Jonathan but not looking at the other people that were involved?
Because Jonathan is the one that's not able to defend himself.
Exactly. In early 2004, Nako Brown called and wrote attorney Ravenel asking that his lawyer file an appeal based on missing evidence, but he refused. Ravenel said that he read the letter and found no basis for it, but told him that he was free to file the motion on his own if he wished to do so. Well, how would he be able to get an appeal pushed through without his lawyer? He couldn't. He actually tried, and the Court of Appeals sent everything back to him, and they were like, yeah, you gotta go through your lawyer. Nako Brown filed motions with federal judge Andre Davis, who presided over his bank robbery trial. He did not receive a response, but later learned that his appeal had been denied. He and his wife had to hear about this from the court clerk because the information had already been provided to his attorney, Kenneth Ravenel, who never reached out to his client to tell him that it had been denied. Nako Brown said he called Ravenel and pretended like he didn't know anything about the ruling. So he calls him up and he's like, hey, did you receive a response about that appeal? And he was like, no, I haven't heard anything. And Nako's like, yeah, you have. I already know you have.
Busted.
Yeah. So they get into this big yelling match and there's cursing and everyone's pissed off. So he filed a complaint against him several times, but it just kept falling on deaf ears.
Okay, I'd be pissed too, though.
It's ridiculous. Like, this is your lawyer. Are you kidding me? There are people that believe this is, of course, a suicide case with Jonathan Luna. Like, he was in over his head at work. His debt was out of control. His boss hated him. Maybe
so he just went ahead and stabbed himself in the back a bunch of fucking times.
Yes. Maybe he was involved in stealing the money. Or did he know who did it? And he didn't want to maybe be involved in these plea agreements, but he had to. There's a lot of things that I would question with this, though. I would want to know more about why he was driving through several states that night. Why travel so far just to end your life?
Yep.
Why gas up your car right before doing it? Because as we've learned previously, that's thinking of the future by gassing it up. Why would you worry about buying yourself a drink right before? Because he supposedly went into a gas station and bought not one, but two drinks. Did he buy one for somebody else or were they both for him? Why on earth would he attack himself in the back of his car? That had to be where it took place because that's where most of the blood was. And we learned in the Ellen Greenberg case that most people don't stab themselves through their clothing. But guess what happened here?
Yep.
So, I mean, come on.
And how is he going to mangle his own hands that badly?
Right.
Like, how could you still continue to stab yourself but have... Because, like, you know, either way, if you stab yourself first, you're going to be literally on your way out now mangling your hands somehow with what little energy you have left, or you mangle them beforehand and you literally can hardly even function because you have cuts down to the bone, mm-hmm. but you're still somehow stabbing yourself.
Yes, absolutely. And as we learned in part one, Jonathan loved fashion. Why would he be wearing one of his expensive suits when he did this? Why did he withdraw $200 from the ATM if you're just going to go end your life? Like, there's too many things here that just are not adding up. There's also a theory that he was staging an attack and accidentally ended his life. And this is one that I've actually seen cited a lot as a theory. If he was staging this to look like he was attacked, how was that going to work? Like, he would get all of this sympathy, and maybe the FBI would not administer the polygraph test in 2 days, but okay, that
but
doesn't...
then what?
It's not going to be canceled
There's
forever.
There's no end game to that.
It's just going to be rescheduled. So that's where
and if he wanted
I don't get
to survive,
that theory.
He would... Again, I don't think he would mangle his hands and shit. Like, that's insane.
And his scrotum?
Yeah,
are you
exactly.
kidding? That would... That does not make any sense.
To prove
sense.
A point?
Yeah.
Right.
And he was a smart guy. This just doesn't seem to be like a well thought out plan to do to yourself. Now, it could be well thought out in the sense of if somebody was staging it, someone else, but for him specifically doing it, I don't get it. Also, Jonathan was actively seeking out press to be in the courtroom the next morning when he handed out that plea deal. So, like, why would you do that if you're worried about, you know, getting it completed? It doesn't make sense.
No, it does not.
And if he knew he was going to go end his life that night, you just wouldn't go say, hey, reporter, can you make sure your ass is in court the next morning for this plea agreement?
It would be real weird.
Yeah. He alerted reporters that they would want to be in court that morning for the deal. Like, he wanted them to be waiting for him. How did he get clear defensive wounds all over his hands and arms if he did this to himself? Also, again, like, why the fuck would you slash your scrotum? I can't move past that. I can't.
Yeah, it doesn't. No.
I don't know. Maybe that makes sense to somebody else. I just don't get it.
No.
And then what about the blood in the rear passenger footwell of his vehicle? There was also a second blood type that was later reported to have been found in his car. How do you explain that?
Okay, that's
He's got
sketch.
Two blood types?
Wow.
And the spot of Jonathan's blood on the turnpike ticket.
Either he's pregnant and a baby has
another blood type.
Or he's the first person in history to have two different blood types.
Right.
Wow. It's quite impressive, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, okay, so his blood showing up on the turnpike ticket. Investigators actually tried to explain this one away. They said that the drop of Jonathan's blood on the turnpike ticket was unrelated to his death, and they believed that he just got, like, a little scratch on his hand or something.
Oh, just a little scratchy.
Yeah, just a little scratch.
Okay.
You know, that he inflicted himself.
Oh, right.
Of course.
Yeah.
And so that was just a little accident.
Mm.
It meant nothing.
Interesting.
Right. No one in Jonathan's inner circle said that he was suicidal. And he was planning that trip. He was looking forward to going on it with his father. Also, Sallie Mae was the student loan servicing agency that Jonathan was making payments to. They returned his last payment because it was received after his death. So let me ask you, why would he make a loan payment if he was going to end his life?
If he was going to go kill himself. That'd be weird.
It is very strange. It doesn't make any sense because you know, after you die, they can't accept that money.
Yep.
On March 12th, 2004, officials held a press conference in Baltimore. And this is where they said that there were three possibilities in this case.
Oh.
Okay. This is a big revelation, okay?
Alrighty.
So number one, homicide.
Oh. I was like, damn.
Okay, Hannah, ready? Number two.
Suicide?
Yes. And number three.
So homicide, suicide.
Three is a random act of violence.
Oh. Okay. That would be quite a random act.
Yes, but I just, dude, it's so ridiculous to me that they have a press conference and they're like, you guys, here's the possibilities.
Like the literal three things that
are thought of in every scenario.
Every single, yeah.
But okay. They went over a timeline of Jonathan's last movements and revealed that Jonathan had actually driven through four states. Not three. Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. He also had contact with someone between the time he left his office on December 3rd and when he was found dead at 5:30 a.m. the next morning. So who was that person? Well, that part isn't clear. And yes, they've backtracked on that as well. 2 years after Jonathan's death, his friends, family, and other people invested in this case held a vigil at the murder scene. They demanded a real investigation. There hadn't been any movement on the case, and Lancaster County Coroner Dr. Barry Wulp retired, and he was replaced by Lancaster physician Dr. Gary Kirshner. As the anniversary of Jonathan's death grew closer, someone from the FBI went to the coroner and requested that he just go ahead and change the cause of death from homicide to suicide.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. Just change it.
Yeah. Not a big deal.
Don't worry.
Nobody will even know.
So the new coroner, gets this request and reviewed the facts of the case, and he refused.
He was like, fuck no.
Yeah,
thank
he was
God.
Like, this is a homicide. So that is what it remains. Chief Karcher does not agree with the FBI that this is suicide. He says it's homicide.
Yes!
He said that on the night of Jonathan's death, his department was not notified by the state police. The state police responded to the after-hours call, and one of Karcher's men heard about the murder investigation later on. He said it's really unusual for things to work out that way, and it had never happened before. He also said that there was something so strange about the knife. It was discovered almost 2 months after Jonathan's death in January. The stream ran around a small rock, and the knife was supposedly found by the rock, but it had been thoroughly searched by FBI agents and Pennsylvania State Police. The state police brought in 150 cadets to search the area after the murder. They did the shoulder-to-shoulder grid search, covering every square foot of the scene, and the knife was not found. Then it's later discovered in the exact spot where Jonathan's body had been.
Wow.
So you're going to have to really explain that one to me, because that seems incredibly sketch.
Yep.
They also had weeks of high water in the creek, and the knife wasn't washed away.
That's what I was going to, actually, that was one of the things I was going to point out, because I was sitting here thinking, it's a literal stream,
and a small knife
is in motion, so you're going to tell me it didn't get carried away that entire time?
No.
Nobody else disturbed it or accidentally kicked it more into the water, nothing?
So is it just something that, oops, they accidentally missed it, or did somebody come back later and place that knife there?
Right.
Who knows? On the morning of Jonathan Luna's death, December 4th of 2003, he should have been in court at 9:30 a.m. Judge Quarles was there. probably irritated that he was late 2 days in a row, thinking to himself, that's going to cost another $25. It took several hours for his body to be identified and for the news to reach his boss, U.S. Attorney Tom DiBaggio. The court reporter, Ned Richardson, would unknowingly be a stenographer for a murder investigation. Waiting at the prosecution table was U.S. Attorney James Warwick. This was the man that Jonathan had spoken to the night before when he was trying to push that Smith and Poindexter plea agreement through.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
James Warwick was also the assistant attorney who one investigator complained was pressuring him to open phony cash storefronts in his investigations. The investigator believed that this was run by a network of unaccountable agents and informants. When court started that morning, James Warwick said to Judge Quarles, quote, I do apologize for, I guess, my sudden appearance before the court. Yesterday, I became involved in some discussions with Mr. Tuminelli relative to his client, and so I have obtained at least a limited degree of knowledge of what the issues are. I do believe that we do have something worked out with Mr. Tuminelli. Mr. Luna was finalizing the agreement. I spoke with Mr. Luna last night. I don't know where he is at the moment. We're trying to locate him and trying to locate the final agreement. The plea agreement was never completed, and it was sitting in Jonathan Luna's office on his laptop. An internal investigations expert later reviewed the transcript and was shocked to see that James Warwick was in the courtroom that day. It didn't make any sense for him to be there. He was also astonished that Jonathan's boss, Tom DiBaggio, would even allow the plea agreement to move forward when Jonathan was missing that morning. When Jonathan didn't arrive to work that morning, DiBaggio should have gone to the courtroom and told the judge he was missing and we need to stop this case until he's located. I mean, we know, we've talked about it before, like, this is a scary job. Anything could happen, and, like, what if he was in danger? Well, obviously he was, you know, but I don't know that everyone jumps to that conclusion immediately. James Warwick stood before the judge and laid out the facts that had been discussed the night prior with Jonathan Luna. He said he had only been consulted for a short period, but the weird thing to me on this is if he was only talked to briefly about this case, how did he seem to know so much about the murder that had entered into the case? And that would be the murder of Elvin Jones. He said that they were not able to establish that the murder of Alvin Jones was related to drugs, so they could go ahead and move forward with that plea deal to reduce the sentences for both Deion Smith and Walter Poindexter. James Warwick requested a 15-minute recess to obtain the plea agreement. Before word reached the judge about Jonathan's death, James Warwick went into Jonathan's office, used his computer, altered the document, and completed the plea agreements. During his recess, people were supposedly sent to look for Jonathan to see if his vehicle was in the parking garage. So James Warwick entered the courtroom with the two completed agreements, and it only took him 30 to 45 minutes to do so. If you think back to how long Jonathan Luna spent staring at those documents, one could potentially conclude that he just simply didn't want to finish them.
Yep.
Because he sat there for hours, and he was in the office and then went home for dinner, then came back to the office to complete it. Like, there was a lot of time spent there. And this man, who supposedly barely knows anything about it, can crank it out in 30 to 45 minutes.
Skim right over.
Yeah. Yeah. James Warwick said he was ready for the signatures, and the moment Walter Poindexter put his name on that paper, he was prohibited by the government from ever appealing the case. Everyone signed their parts, and Warwick signed both agreements as Jonathan P. Luna, and he added his own initials after he signed Jonathan's name. Attorney Archie Tuminelli says there's no way that James Warwick didn't already know everything about that case before Jonathan consulted with him.
Yep.
He was there, and Jonathan didn't even tell him the facts. James Warwick asked them what the problem was, and Archie Tuminelli said he wanted the murder charges dropped, and James Warwick said, well, you can do that. That's fine. How would he be able to offer that advice without knowing anything about the case? It's also interesting that he was able to just jump right in and take over the case right away when Jonathan didn't show up, and he slammed through those agreements so quickly. Wouldn't you need to know about the case that you're writing a plea agreement for?
You would sure think so.
You would. So that's where we're ending this one. And next week, we're going to do a deeper look at the timeline of Jonathan's last movements.
Yeah, I'm excited for that part.
Yes, because it's going to bring you a lot more, you know, deeper information of what we have. Jonathan's former boss, Thomas DiBiagio, ends up being forced to resign. Attorney Kenneth Ravenel was arrested, but it's not in relation to Jonathan's death.
Oh.
We're going more in depth about what happened on the day that the $36,000 went missing.
Oh, okay.
Especially because it keeps getting brought up so many times.
Yes.
The county coroner was told that they did not have any records on Jonathan Luna because they had been turned over to the FBI, but his records were mysteriously located somewhere else.
Hmm.
So,
huh.
That's all that we have to look forward to next week.
I am looking forward to it.
Good. All right, so make sure to follow us on any of your podcast apps. Tell us the stories you want to hear. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Leave us a 5-star review if you love us. Tell your friends, tell your cats. Bye.